So, Scott, I have two potential questions.
Yes.
One, are you okay?
No. My name is not Annie either. That's the second question.
Ian,
that actually wasn't the joke, but like I appreciate that too.
Ian, you have made that exact joke before.
Ian has like four jokes.
I know, and it's just it's all
about
the timing.
Because he invented jokes, he gets the pass.
Are we recording? Annie, are you okay? Are we recording? But we did it the second time. That's his third joke. It's the first one again.
Hey, I made friends with you all. That was another joke. You're forgetting that one.
Hi, welcome to Brought to the Table. We have here today, live in the non-studio, non-live audience, who is not the audience, but the presenters, talking on this podcast today, Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, Carter, Caitlin Phillips, and me, the host, Scott Pruitt. I'm not doing anything except telling you these names today, and probably telling you something else annoying, but everybody else is going to be talking. We have two groups today. We're going to see Caitlin talk about something, Carter make non-witty banter, and then we're going to have Diana and Ian argue for 3 hours.
Woo!
I'm very sorry. We're probably going to cut out two of those hours and probably another 59 of the minutes. So, unfortunately, you will not get to see most of it or hear it.
You don't get to see anything normally.
So, to establish who goes first today, we're going to play a fun game called Where Is That Music From?
Oh, no.
Is it, like, in your fucking room?
That would be a correct answer, but I would not accept it.
It's from under your bed.
I'm going to play you a couple of quick songs, and I'm going to ban Carter from answering because he's already heard all of them.
Ah,
wait.
Shit.
I'm handicapped now.
Yes, you are. I don't think this will go as well as you think it's going to. All right. For the first one, this one I imagine nobody will get, and if you do, you deserve to go first. Anybody yet?
I'm gonna say Farmers Only.
It's likely this guy's probably played it for you. I can't do this one, Scott.
Carter, what is this one?
You can't do this one? This
Steven Universe?
No.
This is Music of the Night from Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, that's why I can't get it.
Oh, I would not have gotten
that. There you go. So.
It makes sense now that I know what the answer is.
Would you like to go again?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. This one, hopefully, is easier for someone here.
Oh, I got it.
Anyone?
Jeez.
I will let you just say where it's from.
I just hear acoustic guitar and I'm like, probably Stardew Valley.
That's good.
Oh no! I like recognize the tune, but I can't think of where it's from.
I've heard it, but...
That would be the song from Tangled, I See the Light.
It did actually sound kind of familiar as we kept playing.
That's good.
It sounded super familiar, but
yeah, I would not have got
it.
That.
Yeah, I didn't think Ian would get it, but I expected Caitlin.
I love Tangled. I don't know
why.
Yeah,
you're friends with Christina.
Christina does like Tangled, but I actually like Tangled more than Christina does.
Okay, we're going to try one more, and if you don't get it, we're going to a boring-ass trivia question.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to think of other Disney songs I know now.
I got it. It's Kiss the Girl, Little Mermaid.
There you go.
Woo!
I actually was about to get that one. It took me a second.
I wanted to double check, so I wanted to listen to more to make sure I knew.
And you win. You get to go first, Diana. What are you talking about?
Scott, are you ready?
I was born ready.
Are you, all of these listeners in the cast today, ready for the man, the myth, the legend, Jesus stole his hairstyle, beard and all. We are all ready for Ian Walker.
We're cutting like all of that out, right?
Oh yeah.
All right, good. All right, so what I've got here today to talk about is a little thing called labeling theory. Labeling theory is something that, like, I found out about a couple years ago, and it was something that was like really interesting for the simple fact that it explained a lot of interactions that I had been seeing both among like people that I talked to or people that I saw interacting online. And a good example is something, just go with, say, think of a fangirl. Automatically, everybody has an image in their head.
Think of a
metalhead. Somebody, you're just automatically have those ideas. Those are all labels that we attach to people. Most of the time, those are labels that we attach to other people. And we use those labels to sort of like define and put people into easy to determine boxes. Essentially, like, what label theory is going off of is that us doing that, putting people into these boxes by attaching labels to them, can actually make them more like the labels that we're attaching to them. Those labels that they actually will determine or influence the behaviors and the identity that those people have for themselves. And for me, that was a really weird fact of, like, a lot of the times you think, hey, I'm going to make myself this way. I'm going to, you know, this is what I think, this is what I feel, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be this. And you normally think that, like, labels are something that you make yourself, which I think that's what they should be. You should use labels to define who you are and to tell everybody else, this is who I am. But with labeling theory, what it goes into is that the sort of, like, labels that you get are more often from the majority of people, sort of like sectioning off minorities and like saying, this is what you are. This is the box that we are putting you in. And like, you have these sort of behaviors that are expected of you. And it essentially kind of becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy and leads to more stereotyping of individuals because it's, hey, if you have this label, then you're this sort of person. End of story. It makes it easier for us to think about you, so we're not going to take any of the hard time to actually get to know you.
So is this kind of similar, and I know this is like a super small scale version of this, but would this be similar to how people define themselves as dog people or cat people?
So, I mean, that could be a part of it that you could look into. Like, that, again, is another label. Most of the time, if you think about it, like, think of a dog person. Most people would probably think somebody who's like, yeah, dogs are awesome. I love dogs. Like, amazing. But they absolutely hate cats. Cats killed their family. Like, that sort of thing. Oh, like, there's not many dog people that I know that are like, yeah, I'm also a cat person. If you're saying you're a dog person, you're all about dogs. Fuck cats. Like, the worst thing in existence. But
okay.
That's the thing, is not everybody who actually is a dog person, they don't all hate cats. It's just that's the way that our brains work, that we look for these sort of shortcuts, and we try to use as little effort as possible to come to correct conclusions, because that saves us time, that saves us energy, and we're really just kind of lazy things. One of the main things that labeling theory goes into, again, like I was saying, like, the difference between the majority of a population labeling the minority, is the sort of idea of deviance. And the fact that deviance really isn't something that is inherent to an act. Any sort of act can be deviant, but that doesn't mean that specific acts are actually deviant. It's all based upon what the majority of the population decides is the normal, is the standard that everybody is judged off of. And so going off of that, you know, in Western culture, like in the United States, we have certain things that are considered very deviant, very taboo. Like, you do not have, like, incest. Immediate shutdown right there. Because there's good reasons for that. You do not eat other people. Again, reasons for that. You also, you don't eat dogs. You don't eat certain things. Like,
Maybe not dogs, because there are places in the world where dog is not an odd thing.
Well, no, but he was saying
see,
America.
That's what I'm... Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Like, in the United States, like, that is a very taboo sort of subject. You don't eat dogs. You can eat cows and chickens and everything, but dogs? No, dogs are off the menu. Literally. But, like, that's the thing. For us, that would be deviant. In other areas of the world, that would be a normal thing. That isn't considered deviant there. So, therefore, people who did that would not be considered outside of the majority for that reason. So... again, it's just the idea that, like, deviance isn't so much a negative thing. It isn't necessarily this idea that deviance is always bad because this act is always bad. It's more of a look into it that deviance and, by extension, crime in and of itself is more a violation of, like, what this society has made as rules or law. Essentially labeling somebody as a deviant satisfies, like, our need to be like, this person isn't part of us. This person is breaking what we think is correct, and therefore we're, like, removing them from our group. And again, you can kind of see where this sort of pressure would lead to negative sort of self-images or self-identity creation, because you have people who are like, hey, I'm not really doing anything wrong, but I'm being, like, ostracized for these actions. And, you know, this could be things that, you know, for them are not actually deviant. So, you know, years ago, and unfortunately still to this day, a lot of people would classify people who are homosexual or bisexual, pansexual, any sort of, like, quote-unquote alternative, like, sexual preference or orientation, they would consider them deviant because that's not what they define as standard or normal. And so you have this idea that these people who are not doing anything wrong on their own are being labeled as deviants or miscreants or are breaking some sort of taboo that is a horrible, horrible thing. And they're being put in this box and told that this is what they are. And that is going to end up becoming a part of that self-identity. And a lot of people will have issues with that because it's, you're basically telling somebody that who they are is awful and they're the worst thing ever, but they're not doing anything to hurt anyone else. They're essentially breaking somebody else's expectations of them, which you shouldn't have those expectations of other people in that sort of their life.
It's reminding me of, like, national identity, you know, like, how we use, like, oh, he's Irish, or, I mean, how we currently do this in the very racist world we live in. Well, that got less ironic.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, that again, is part of what labeling theory goes off of, is that you not just, well, everybody does it. It's the thing that you take shortcuts. That's why stereotyping is a thing, is because our brains look for shortcuts. If we can take the time to, like, put an entire person with, like, 3 bullet points and be like, this is this entire person, they fit into this group, that's so much less effort that we have to actually put into figuring out who they are. And so our brains look for that. We, like, our brains love to do that because it's much easier to be like, this person is just this, instead of, all right, well, this person is this, they're also this, they're also this, they're also this. And getting to know what an entire person is like, that takes a lot of effort. It's not a bad thing. It's just, it takes a lot of effort for our brains to do. And if our brains can find a shortcut, they're going to take it. And so when it comes to things like national identity, you do have a lot of issues with, you know, racism or nationalism, where people will be looking at this one individual person and identifying them as, like, this poster child of an entire group. And then they'll look at another person in that same group, not even knowing them, and be like, you're exactly like that person. Hands down. No, like, there is nothing to say you are not. I mean, a good example would be somebody could look at Carter and myself and be like, oh yeah, you're both, you know, white kids that went to Tech. You're not wrong, but Carter and I are both very different people. But without taking the time to actually, like, pull that apart, you're not really going to understand that. You could easily just label both of us as Virginia Tech graduates who are white. And that's not an incorrect judgment or label. We are, but it doesn't get at the crux that people itself are much more complex and that we need to be more aware of this in like our social interactions with other individuals.
I do want to briefly point out that Virginia Tech graduates who are white describes all of us.
That is fair. I guess I was going more off of the fact that, like, Carter and I are both, like, white male graduates from Virginia Tech. Sure. But, yeah, good point.
So, I was wondering, when you were talking about labeling theory as it relates to yourself, because you talked about how we self-label and then we have this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, is there any way to kind of recognize that about yourself? Like, I label myself as a sweets person, but I wake up one day and realize I hate the flavor vanilla, which is usually, I don't know, considered part of, like, the standard sweets.
The good
you know,
shit.
Contraband. But, like, how do you recognize that about yourself? If you've been telling yourself your whole life that I love vanilla because I am a sweets person, how do you, like, is there any way to break yourself out of that?
So, I think what I would suggest with it is, like, this is also a little bit outside of labeling theory, just because labeling theory mainly deals with, like, how those labels impact other individuals and how those labels are created. It's kind of less about the idea of, hey, this is what I do. Like, it's more about somebody giving you a label than you making that label for yourself, which I think that is the key part to this right here, is the fact that I think labels are something that people should create for themselves in order to tell others what they identify as. I think labels aren't for other people to describe you. I think that's for you to use to describe yourself. Labels are a personal thing. They're not a thing for others.
And that sort of leads me into my question that I've got for labeling theory and whatnot. You know, I think in an ideal world, you know, what you just said would be correct. You know, we use labels to describe ourselves and sort of use that as a way to sort of broadcast who we are to the world or to ourselves even, you know, just sort of put ourselves into these nice boxes. But before you were talking about how we assign labels to people and then when we learn more about what they are, we sort of force them out of those labels. So first you meet me, and this is a bad example because this isn't really a box that you put people into, but you meet me and I'm a Virginia Tech, a white male Virginia Tech graduate. Like, you put me into that box and you know roughly what I am. And then as you get to know me over time, you sort of take me out of that box. Is that right? Is that sort of how this process goes?
Yeah, like that is definitely a part of what can happen. So if you have no exposure to an individual of, say, again, using your example, white male Virginia Tech graduate, if you have no exposure to somebody on a personal level who fits into that label, then you're going to just automatically assume everybody who has that label is going to behave in a certain way. You can meet someone briefly and be like, oh, you're a white male Virginia Tech graduate. I already have these preconceived notions that you're going to act in this sort of way. And if that's the only time I meet you, you're going to stay in that box. Like, unless you do something really big that throws you out of that box immediately, you're going to stay in that box. But as you get more and more exposure, you sort of are forced, in a sense, to come to terms with, like, wait a minute, this guy is a white male Virginia Tech graduate, but he doesn't do this, or he does this instead, or this. And so, like, essentially the way that I think would be the best to come to terms with how we attach labels to others is, again, to have that exposure to a wide variety of individuals. Something that I have seen, which I cannot really talk about because, like, again, I am a white male, like, in the United States. I really don't experience, like, racism on, like, directed towards me. But a lot of what I've seen is a good process for working against racism is to have people actually interacting with each other. The more that you interact with other individuals that are different from you, the wider your worldview becomes, the more likely you are to actually see them as individual people with their own complex lives that are different yet identical in the sense that they are human to you. They aren't any different. They aren't the other. They are also human.
I'm going back to what Diana said because, man, if you guys could have seen my face as she was going through her question. You're fine. You brought up, it's going to take me a second to get myself together here.
I'm so sorry.
No, you're fine. So I grew up in a very white, upper middle class suburban area, and everyone was white and straight and, you know, normal. And the most important thing was to be normal. And then I went to college and I was like, this is a great opportunity to convince everyone that I'm perfectly normal. All this to say is that I tried to keep myself in that box so hard that I ended up really hurting myself because I'd been gay the whole time, secretly. And I don't know, it was just wild because it's exactly what you've been saying. You know, if I had been in an environment where I did actually know queer people, if I had met people, if my only experience with women who were attracted to women wasn't like predatory, you know, my it might have been very different, this whole labeling process. But instead, it was very limited just because of my limited experiences. So, I don't know. It...
No, yeah, definitely. I had a moment. That is very much like what it is like. Like, again, I grew up in a very military family. My father was active military for like the first 13 years of my life. There was a lot of pressure of like, this is the specific mold that you have to fit into, that if you don't, there is something wrong with you and you need to fix it. I very much do not fit like that mold at all, and have had a lot of trouble years ago dealing, and still to this day, like dealing with the fact of that. Just because I don't fit in that mold and I don't fit that label, what does that mean for me? What is my self-identity? I have to basically recreate that. And it is a very big trip because, like, I can come up with what it means to me, but for a lot of people, that's going to be somewhat different. And so if I tell people, like, hey, I identify as, like, polyamorous, therefore, this is what that means to me. It means that I can love multiple people. It means that just because I love someone doesn't mean that I have to have sex with them, that I can love someone just as much regardless of how we interact. To other people, that might not be the exact same that they would label somebody as polyamorous. A lot of people lump in swinging or polyfidelity or polygamy or polyandry, all of these sort of other non-monogamous, you know, orientations or identities under this one umbrella of polyamory. And while all of those are perfectly normal and valid for everybody who identifies as them, that might not be the ones that I identify as. And so people would have the wrong idea of who I am or what I see myself as. And so, you know, you, with what you were saying, with like having that more exposure to, hey, this isn't a bad thing. This isn't something that is deviant. This isn't something that is like the worst choice you can make. If you had more exposure, like, yeah, no, this is fine, you would have most likely a much easier time feeling like, hey, I'm okay. This is okay for me. I am doing good. But because there's much more of that pressure of you have to fit in, you have to be normal, you have to be straight, you have to be this, you have to, you know, wait until marriage to have sex. But at the same time, if you have sex, you know, or before then, and you're going to be a prude if you don't, and you're not cool. Like, society is filled with these contradictions, but you're bombarded with, you have to make sense of all of it. And if you can't, you're the one that's messed up. You're the one that has the problem. You're the one that's broken. And that eventually just becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy of, everyone is telling me that I'm this way, I guess I am. That's not a way for anybody to really live.
Yeah, even just within the very specific ecosystem of my high school, it was cool to be friends with the gay guys. So there were actually, like, gay men who were out in high school, you know, which is great. But there was one lesbian who was out, and there were many bisexuals who would be, you know, secretly out to a handful of people, just because none of us had ever met anyone. We only had like TV stereotypes of rabid men haters and crazy women who were going to, like, seduce you and then kill you, like, oh, you've been a pervert this whole time because we had gym class together, like, seriously, every single generic homophobic thing that you can think of that, yeah, for whatever reason made me be like, all right, I've got a real good chance to be normal and cool here, and I will do that, and that means I don't ever think girls are cute. Like,
that's the unfortunate truth of how a lot of our society interacts with each other, is that they do attach these labels, and they say there's no problems with these labels, just keep using them.
Yeah.
So I think that would be, like, my main takeaway from all of this is we do this every day. Everybody does this. Everybody makes labels or uses labels to identify other individuals that they don't know at all. And sometimes that works. However, you're not going to get a good idea of that person. The best way to understand a person is to actually interact with them and have those multiple interactions. Also, if somebody tells you, hey, I identify as this, don't immediately assume that your idea of what that label means is the correct one. If they say, hey, this is what I identify, be like, hey, that's great. Can you explain that to me so I fully understand it? Honestly, that is probably one of the biggest ways to clear up any of the misunderstandings of what a person's label identifies them as. And also just, like, take the time to get to know people. Stop using labels as heavily as, like, oh, well, this person says they're this, their person says they're this, this person says they're this. Like, that's good and all, but get to know them.
That's, all right.
Yeah, that's all I got.
That was a fun topic. We're going to head over to a quick break so you can recover your brain from all this thinking.
We're going to fucking smash it to pieces again.
Yup.
Yeah, we're going to blow your mind after the break. But, you know.
Am I a shock talk now? Like,
yes. Yeah. Well, we are. We're prepping for together, you. Together. You asked me to be your hype man, okay?
You got
to
hype. I'm trying. You have to hype.
You got to hype, not Scott.
What was that?
You legally have to hype me up.
Was that not hype?
Let's leave now. So the break is going to start. While you're on the break, think about subscribing to all of our various different channels. You're listening to us somehow right now, and that place probably has a button for you to hit subscribe or a place where you can subscribe somewhere else. So do it.
Bash the bad boy. Bad boy being the subscribe button. Don't just, like, beat up a child.
No, do it.
I mean, do if you want. No,
don't.
It's probably illegal, so don't.
Be back in 30 seconds.
Let us go to intermission, please.
Being swallowed by Alf again.
No, stop with that alien vor shit.
Hi, and welcome back from the marvelous break you just had. It really wasn't that long. I don't know why we keep calling it a break. As I said before, we're now going to have Caitlin talk about something and Carter add some non-witty banter.
That's true.
Caitlin, would you like to start?
No, I would like my hype man to start, obviously.
Caitlin, this is not allowed.
Carter, hype me up.
Is Caitlin Phillips, everybody. She's here to talk about gay people and how the government sometimes says no thank you.
Sometimes
says no thank you. All right, I'll accept that. You gotta do better though, court jester.
You gotta hire a better hype man.
I don't want to be Hype Man. I'm a terrible superhero.
Please?
No, you're just horrible at it.
I've already done it.
All right.
Listen, there are small monsters on my phone that need to get into a different part of my phone.
You can't. You have to help me.
Carter, we will make you put a dollar in the douchebag jar. Remember, no phones out.
I don't know where the douchebag jar even is.
Hey, listen, I'm ready to go, and I would love Carter's attention, please.
You have it. What do you want from me
right now? Does Pikachu have it instead?
The rest of us don't have to give attention.
Does Pikachu have it?
No, I threw Pikachu on the ground.
All right.
You happy? The little yellow rat's sad now.
Well, I'm not happy about that, but I want everyone to pay attention to me now. Please and thank you. Yep. All right. I have a question. The question is, what does tentacle porn, the foot pop cliche in movies a la Princess Diaries, and the trope bury your gaze have in common?
You know when, like, a girl... Like, when there's a big romantic kiss between a guy and a girl, the girl's foot always pops up.
Oh, okay, that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, no one said the stereotypical gender roles. Answer. Oh, okay, well.
I thought it was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I thought it was, too.
No, it was a real-ass question. The answer censorship. Okay.
Foot pops or
oh,
censored?
I get it. I got that one. I just put that one together.
All right, I'll throw out an explanation, because I did bring up those cursed words, although this segment as a whole is going to be real light on those tentacles. All I mean by that is censorship in Japan dates back to the something period. M-E-I-J-I. I don't know how you pronounce that.
No,
Maiji?
That doesn't sound right. You gotta
wait,
give it an
M-E-I-J-I?
Yeah, but Japanese.
Maji? Mijai? Maji?
We'll go with it.
Oh my god, I should know this. I actually took a class on this.
Influenced by European Victorian cultures, obscenity was prohibited. Obscenity still is prohibited, but the definition of that has just shifted wildly. Anyway, Wikipedia includes the following buckwild sentence, which is, leaders within the tentacle porn industry have stated that much of their work was initially directed at circumventing this policy. Specifically, exposed genitalia and pubic hair were illegal. But a tentacle? That sure isn't a penis. That's a tentacle. But that's not the focus. That's just the sexy lead in. Oh no, it's not sexy. That's just the tantalizing teaser to get you to pay attention to me, which I desperately need. Let's talk about America. There is something called the Hays Code, and you can look this up on like Wikipedia and TV Tropes and all that shit if you want a more in-depth look at it. But I'm just gonna quickly run through the Hays Code. It is basically a censorship code for movies that was followed for a while, and many other forms of media, obviously, also had censors, but the Hays Code is kind of just a good example of, you know, general attitudes towards various forms of media at the time, and is a good jumping off point. And because it was specifically for movies, it's led to a bunch of different cliches and tropes within movies and to a lesser degree books that I just thought was really interesting. So, anyway, in 1915, the Supreme Court ruled that films don't qualify under First Amendment protections. Congress then considered creating a national censorship board, but Hollywood was like, oh, please don't do this. Also, states were starting to determine their own censors, and again, movie studios were like, oh no, that's way too much work. I don't want to release the Kansas cut of the movie and the New York cut of the movie. That's so much editing. So, from 1930 to 1968, most U.S. motion pictures released by major studios were subject to the Hays Code, named after Will Hays, who was president of the Motion Picture Association of America at the time, in 1930. Adopted in 1930, and it started getting enforced in 1934. Hays was the former postmaster. This is foreshadowing. The code was created partially as a result of a bunch of just crazy scandals in Hollywood in the 1920s. Fatty Arbuckle was a wildly popular movie star who was involved in the murder of William Desmond Taylor and the alleged rape of Virginia Rapp. There were also a bunch of like really risque films and assorted other scandals that just got Hollywood a lot of negative attention. So Hayes first suggested to studio execs that they consider these things for film censorship. It was the don'ts and the be carefuls, 11 subjects best avoided and 26 subjects to be handled carefully. It was approved by the FTC, but there wasn't actually any way to enforce it at this point. I am going to give you the 11 just to give you an idea of like what their priorities were, though. So, first, pointed profanity, including the words God, Lord, Jesus, Christ, hell, damn, God, with a W, that's why I said it like that, and every other profane and vulgar expression, however it may be spelled. Any suggestive nudity, in fact, or in silhouette. The illegal traffic in drugs. Any inference of sex perversion. White slavery. Black slavery, I guess, was fine. Which is fucked up for the 1930s.
Have you seen this country?
That's true. So no white slavery, no sex relationships between different races, which has a specific word for it, miscegenation. I can't pronounce anything. Sex hygiene and venereal diseases, scenes of actual childbirth, again, in fact or in silhouette. They were real big on those silhouettes. Children's sex organs, ridicule of the clergy, and willful offense to any nation, race, or creed. Anyway, so you can see there's a whole lot of white shit, a whole lot of religious shit, and a whole lot of nothing that could be remotely considered perverse. Later on, there were more people involved in more codes and standards that got submitted to major studios. They were still going through refining it, like I said, until 1930, and then later 1934, they actually started to get the power to enforce. In the end, there were, again, two general parts to it. There were general principles which prohibited a picture from lowering the moral standards of those who see it, and also particular applications, a specific list of items that just could not be depicted. Interestingly, even though there was this specific-ass list, some things were just assumed to be understood, like, namely, there's a ban on any sort of homosexuality or the use of certain curse words. I think it's kind of strange that those were just left inferred, considering there were a lot of, you know, particular applications. There were a lot of things that were specifically banned. But regardless, as before, in enforcement, this is mostly focused around cutting out any sort of sexual content and preserving religious figures as well as authority figures. When the code was abandoned in 1968, we started to develop the MPAA film rating system that we know and continue to use a modified version of. The original ratings were G, M, R, which means under 17, not admitted, without an adult, and X for sexually explicit content. That got changed later on because, like, X was then porn and NC-17 and PG-13, et cetera, et cetera. There's a few other different types of codes, like I said earlier, and there's some even with specific other names. Television, comics, and notably, for anything dispersed through the mail. Remember that foreshadowing? Named after former postmaster William Hayes. Anyway, so what I really think is cool about this is the applications and effects of the Hayes Code. So, the foot pop I mentioned earlier. When a man and a woman are kissing hot and heavy in a movie, and you want to show that, like, you know, the stakes have been raised, normally you would have the man, like, pick up the woman, or the woman, like, jump on the man or something like that. But you can't be having that under this code. That's way too sexual. There was a specific rule in the Hays Code that all women in romantic scenes had to have at least one foot on the floor at all times, which was to say not in a bed. But that also meant that, like, a man can't pick a woman up or something like that. So, the foot pop was adopted as a shorthand. You know, they're kissing, she grabs his lapels, and then just one of her feet, you know, raises itself off the ground. Princess Diaries, like, specifically names and demonstrates this. Let's see. Other various tropes or cliches that were a direct result of the Hays Code is showing married men and women sleeping in separate beds. Even men and women who have children were still shown to sleep in separate beds. Anything with crime and immorality could never be portrayed in a remotely positive light. So that's to say, if anyone performed any sort of immoral act, they then had to be punished. They had to be punished on screen, like later on in the film. It wasn't enough to, you know, show a crime happening and kind of like have a disapproving attitude after it. That character had to get specifically punished later on. No sort of references to sex. In Gone with the Wind, there is a childbirth scene and the characters are literally only shown as shadows, not even silhouettes. You can't mock religion. You can't glorify violence. Can you imagine Taken under the Hays Code? It wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be there. No infidelity. You have to preserve the sanctity of marriage. And you can't display anything perverse, including homosexuality, interracial relationships, bestiality, and venereal diseases. Because those are definitely all the same type of thing. Anyway, now we've gotten to the two reasons why I really wanted to talk about this, which is Bury Your Gays and then lesbian Pulp Fiction. So I had to do all that explaining first so that you could see that gay characters in movies and in literature literally just weren't allowed happy endings because you could never in any way suggest that immoral, there's some air quotes there, behavior was going to get rewarded. So, dead gays, especially if they were predatory, which is often how things were described, or how things were demonstrated within films or books, that there was some sort of a good, straight, married girl who got lured astray by the older, predatory lesbian. Lesbian Pulp Fiction is a really interesting look at this, popular in the 1950s and 60s. So it's called Pulp Fiction because, like, the paper was literally, like, magazine quality, very, very cheap. There were a couple of hardcover books that had lesbian characters in the 1930s, and, you know, that's the first, like, lesbians in literature, in America at least. But these pulps, these cheap books, weren't censored as strongly, but they were still very wary of postal censorship. So even as more and more of these books were written by actual lesbians, or at the very least heterosexual women instead of men, they still ended with tragic endings. The first paperback is Women's Barracks, published in 1950, and the second is called Spring Fire, published in 1952. They both have completely tragic endings. The first one ends with a suicide, and the second ends with insanity, which, like I said before, is very typical. Editors said, hey, we have to get this through the Postal Service, through the censorship. And the specific phrase is, you can't endorse or proselytize homosexuality in any way. So a character either had to turn straight or suffer. You cannot be homosexual and happy at the end of one of these books. So that's why, that's the answer to the question that I had, which was, hey, even books written about lesbians by lesbians still end with a bunch of dead gay characters. Like, why has that happened? And the answer is the Postal Service. The first exception, which also was technically not a pulp, it was printed on higher quality paper, is The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith in 1952, where lesbians did get a happy ending. It was adapted into the 2015 drama film Carol, and also the book was just republished as Carol in 1990. And there were a couple of other authors around that time, you know, the 1950s and the 1960s, where authors made a point of giving the gays happy endings. There's also this very good New Yorker article that talks about how the Hays Code wasn't entirely bad for women. There were a lot of wild things for women, like they can't be unfaithful, you know, they have to be subservient, et cetera, et cetera. But this did allow women to portray more complicated characters in a way, instead of just being like the sex pot or the witty one-liners or something like that. There's a lot of examples of women getting to explore more complex parts and have more in-depth dialogue during this period of heavy censorship. So, the Hays Code, it wasn't all bad, but it was pretty bad, and it's a useful shorthand when you're thinking about, what were the censorship attitudes around then? And also, like, I just think the foot pop thing is fascinating.
Yeah, the foot pop threw me for a moment of, like, how does this relate?
Yeah, I definitely didn't see how that tied in at first whenever you just gave the list, because it's like, the other things is like, yeah, I could definitely see how that would be censorship, but like, the foot pop is just such a ubiquitous thing that like, where did that come from? But wow.
Yeah, as I was researching into the foot pop, they, someone, I can't remember who, even made a point, I think it was TV Tropes, made a point of being like, you will see people, men and women, do the foot pop in legitimate pornographic films still. Even though, like, back in the day, it was there as shorthand for, you know, the man picking the woman up, or the woman throwing her legs around the man's waist, or something that's much more obviously sexual. It's still used in these things that aren't censored at all.
I thought that was always just one of those, like, naturally agreed upon symbols, like when they show the ocean for people doing
it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't realize it was because it was explicitly censored that they could only have 1 foot off the ground.
Yep, only 1 foot at a time.
Which, like, why is that what they decided on, like, 1 foot? Like,
well, so...
That seems to me, like, the people making the movie are like, sorry, you can't have 2 feet off the ground. They're like, fuck it, we'll do 1 foot.
Like, serious negotiation there.
I'm sorry that I just kind of yelled to myself for 15 minutes, but I hope that you guys enjoyed the journey.
That I really like that segment.
No, yeah, that was good.
One of the more, like, just, like, informative segments that I think people will just find generally interesting, yeah, that we've had.
Cool.
Kind of like what we thought Quan would be, except we butchered
it. Except for we butchered it, yes. We did a very bad job.
Wait, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions ever, except for a lot, all the time.
I was too baffled to have questions.
Don't know what to ask.
All right, if you have questions, email me.
So, thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Brought to the Table. If you actually liked listening to this and you want to listen to us more, you can find us all over the internet and social media, Facebook, Tumblr. Our alias is Brought to the Table, or just search for Brought to the Table. On Twitter, if for some reason you still use Twitter, you can look at to the table pod, because apparently podcast is too long to fit in a Twitter handle. They are really tight on storage, you know, with that like limit on text and stuff.
They
like
just
that.
Bumped it. They must have gotten like 10 more gigs of RAM or something.
Oh, wow.
It's hard to be Twitter.
So feel free if you want to send us fan mail, hate mail, or submit your own things you want us to talk about. We have a Gmail, which is broughttothetable@gmail.com. Send it there. Somebody will read it. We'll probably take it under advisement, and we would really love if you actually sent us something, because I don't think we've gotten any before. So be the first. If you are listening to us on some platform, which you probably are because you're hearing the words I'm saying right now, leave us a review, like iTunes has a review section. You can also probably hit the subscribe button, like I said before. Sometimes it's green. It'll usually say the word subscribe. This way, you don't miss episodes. Thanks for coming to our table, and later.
Bye.
Peace. Bye.
Later.
Hawaiian pizza.